Well, welcome today to our interview. We have a lovely lady with us today. I'd like to introduce you to Lucy.
Hello.
Lucy is someone that I met as part of a wonderful group of alternative therapists and practitioners. And in actual fact, we're going to be working together very soon on a wellbeing bazaar, which is a very exciting project that's now really growing, with lots and lots of alternative practitioners and therapists all getting together to create a really wonderful day for people to come and learn how alternative therapies can help them, whatever their situation. Now, I want to thank you so much, Lucy, for agreeing to be interviewed today, because I know that the wisdom that you're going to share really is going to be so important to those listening, because you yourself suffered with ME for quite a long time, didn't you?
Yes, yeah.
So can you just tell us how long did your illness last?
Well, I was diagnosed with ME in the year 2000, but I was actually ill for quite a long time before that, probably about 3 or 4 years, when I just didn't seem to have any energy. I was catching anything that was going around. If I worked in an office where people had the flu, I'd catch the flu. If there was a tummy bug going around, I'd catch a tummy bug. I was forever worn out. I was feeling depressed. Kept going back to the doctor. And I took quite a lot of antibiotics over a period of 2 years, because I would go back to the doctor and say, look, I can't afford to have time off work. I have to get better quickly because I need to get back to work. And of course, this was probably the worst thing I could do under the circumstances. But at the time, I was still in that place where I thought, I have got to work. I have got to keep going. And so my health deteriorated. I was going through quite a lot of emotional things at the same time. Recently divorced. I'd moved across the country to live in a different town. Two teenage sons at senior school, so a lot of emotional stuff as well as the physical illness. And then in January 2000 I caught the flu, and this was that really bad flu that went round, and I just didn't recover from it. And I went back to the doctor after about 3 months, and I said, I'm still not well. I've still got the flu. And he said, you can't possibly have the flu for 3 months. And he sent me to the hospital. And I had a chest x-ray and various blood tests. And when I went back to the GP, he said, well, you're borderline everything. You know, you're not bad enough to be treated for anemia or thyroid, and your chest is okay. So it looks like it's post-viral fatigue. And I just didn't recover.
No.
That's what happened.
So you just went home, and what happened then?
Well, what I should have done, I suppose, is just take to my bed and be ill. But I didn't. I kept going. So I would go into work, and then I'd have to come home again. I'd, you know, try and cook a meal and try and do all sorts of things, really fooling myself, thinking, I'll be much better soon. You know, this will only last another week or two. And so what happened was my health deteriorated. And I got to the point where I couldn't actually speak properly. I couldn't think clearly. I couldn't climb up and down a flight of stairs. And I became very, very scared, because I was used to being a very capable woman, a very fit woman, a very intelligent woman, someone who just dealt with problems and got on with things. And here I was in a situation where I couldn't control my own speech. I'd worked in salary administration, and I couldn't count the change in my hand. Couldn't stand the light, couldn't stand the dark, couldn't stand listening to voices, couldn't bear being on my own. I loved reading, and I couldn't read. I just couldn't.
It's just, you're completely paralleling my story. It's just, it's just incredible, isn't it, how it has this, it follows this downward spiral, and that always is such a shock for somebody. And we know that, well, pretty much everybody that ends up with this condition has been somebody that has been so capable and has had a very busy, active life. And so there is this disbelief, isn't there?
Yes.
When you suddenly can't do those things anymore.
Yes.
And, you know, can't push through.
Mm.
We kind of identify that as the, you know, when the denial phase comes to an end.
Yeah.
And you then get into that crash phase where you physically can't do it anymore.
Yes. Yes.
So you talked about not being able to speak and not being able to concentrate or count. What were sort of your other main symptoms?
Pain, definitely a lot of joint pain. And really the chronic fatigue was the worst thing because it affected everything.
Yeah.
I just felt too weak to do anything. Sort of being taken out in a wheelchair just felt so alien to me. And I felt angry. I just thought, this person in the wheelchair isn't me.
Yeah.
This is not me. I don't want to be like this. And so there was a lot of anger. There was a lot of fear because I was afraid that if I deteriorated much more, I would end up in hospital.
Mm-hmm.
This overall feeling of weakness, I think, was the worst thing. I then developed allergies and sensitivities. I've always been quite careful. I tended to eat well. And even when I was much younger, I couldn't use certain soap powders because they would affect my skin.
Mm-hmm.
So I know I've always been a sensitive person. But I suddenly found myself unable to drink milk without vomiting. I had IBS symptoms, bloating, great discomfort. I found I really couldn't eat any wheat at all without suffering for it, really. And again, you know, for reasons beyond me at the time, I would comfort eat and comfort drink.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be lying on the couch once the kids had gone to school, and I would have a mug of Horlicks and three digestive biscuits. So, you know, that's sugar, that's dairy, that's gluten, that's all the stuff, you know, that was bad for me.
And that your body couldn't deal with.
Couldn't deal with
it. In such a depleted state.
Couldn't deal with it. I was asking too much of myself.
So we're still kind of trying to self-medicate in some stage at that stage.
Yeah.
Just taking you back to that sort of phase where you just kept trying to push through.
Yeah.
What are the kinds of things, I think it's always interesting for our listeners to know, what were the things you did to try and keep going? What were the things you sort of medicated with, if you like, when you were in that breakdown phase?
I think when I was very tired, instead of resting, I would eat or drink something to keep me going. And I would take painkillers because I was in pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would, for example, I would start the day with painkillers and a coffee. And then I would go to work. And after work, when I came home, I would pour myself a glass of wine. And then when I was getting the meal ready, I'd pour myself another glass of wine because I really didn't have the strength to stand up in the kitchen and prepare a meal. And I was still at that stage, you know, buying everything fresh, cooking from scratch, doing a proper dinner every night. And I'd have a glass of wine with my dinner. And then, you know, there'd be not much wine left in the bottle, so I'd finish the bottle of wine. And at that point, I often literally didn't have the strength to get myself ready for bed, you know, because I probably was sensitive to alcohol before, but certainly once I started on this downward spiral with my health deteriorating, I became so sensitive to alcohol that I couldn't really drink at all without passing out, without feeling really drunk. And so I would have this brief period of time, maybe an hour and a half, when I felt happy and I felt good, and I didn't feel like I had the flu. And it was very upsetting for my kids because they would think I was really drunk when I'd only had maybe one or two glasses of wine. And I, you know, if they spoke to me about it the next day when I was sober, I'd say, it's like a holiday for me. It's my only holiday from ME. Because even if I went away on holiday, I still have the ME. So this 1.5 hours in the evening was my holiday for ME. And they'd say, but Mum, you don't come back from the holiday. And it was so horrible.
Yeah.
So as well as everything else, there was this feeling of degradation, feeling ashamed of myself. And really, shame is a very, very low level of vibration energetically. So I was living with shame, as well as all the other things, you know, the fatigue, the physical pain, the mental weakness, all those things. I was also living in shame because I was ashamed of myself for drinking, which was my self-medicating, but I was also ashamed that I wasn't capable of getting better.
Yeah.
It was as if I was saying to myself, come on, you know, get yourself out of this. You've lived through difficult stuff, you know how to turn things around, you know, you're a failure.
It's that non-acceptance that actually you're ill and you need some help.
Yeah.
That, you know, the mind struggles with, doesn't it? And, you know, we beat ourselves up, really, don't we?
Definitely.
Thank you for being so honest and sharing that.
I just think if it helps other people, because other people will be listening to this and relating to it, and I just hope, you know, that it helps
almost
them.
Almost definitely, and, you know, what you've just told me, we do hear, you know, over and over, so I know that it really will help. So looking back, what was your worst time?
For me, the worst time was in the winter when I probably had ME for about a year because I was diagnosed in the January. So I had actually had ME for a year. And I got to the point where I couldn't have a bath. I was too weak to fasten my own bra. I didn't actually take a shower for 3 years. I didn't have the strength to stand up in a shower. And I've got a photograph of me taken actually in the summer, so this was a lot longer than just the winter. And in the photograph, I look like my boyfriend is standing behind me hugging me. But in fact, he's holding me up because I didn't have the strength to stand up then. So that to me was my worst point.
Is that the lowest point?
That was my lowest
couldn't
point.
Even shower or anything.
No.
What do you believe triggered all of these symptoms in the beginning?
I think it was asking too much of the self. You know, I'm now a healer, and so I know that you can't just look at one area of the self. You can't say physical or emotional or spiritual or intellectual. You know, the whole thing is one. And that one is the self. And I think if I could have had one thing at a time, I would have been okay. If I could have just got divorced, or if I could have just got the bad flu, or, you know, any one of the things, I think myself would have been able to cope with it. I think what happened was all these things happened at the same point in my life. And so I was drawing on energy that wasn't there. So I was having emotional problems, you know, physical illness, a whole range of things all at the same time. And it was too much for me to cope with. And what I did was I went into denial in a way. So I carried on behaving as if there was nothing wrong with me. So the idea that I could go to work and study and, you know, drive people here, there and everywhere and cook the meals from scratch and everything when I really didn't have the energy to be doing any of those things was just asking too much. And I think what happens is a sort of burnout where you just are so depleted that things give up.
Yeah, there's a tipping point.
So
you mentioned your divorce. Do you think that the emotional struggle with that impacted your health?
Definitely. And I do think, and I know this from experience, that feeling unloved is a very unhealthy state to be in. And to go through this whole thing with my ex-husband, you know, a sort of protracted divorce, and then members of my family didn't support me because they thought, you know, it was a perfectly good marriage. Why did I choose to come out of that? So I didn't have emotional support. I didn't feel loved. I didn't feel understood. And certainly when I became ill, I didn't feel understood at all. And so I think the emotional strain of all that definitely triggered a lot of the problems that then became ME.
Without there must have been a build-up to the we talked about the divorce, but there had to be a period leading up to the divorce where you can't have felt good.
And again, it was denial. It was a period of years in which I was putting on a brave face and giving everyone the impression that I was in a very happy marriage and everything was wonderful and I was coping so well. And I wasn't. And I wasn't happy. I was very unhappy. And when I just reached the point where I thought, I have to do something. You know, the stress is getting to me. And I went to a doctor and he said, you have to do something about this stress. Because you're the sort of person who becomes really ill. You know, you have to do something about this. And I just thought, I have to get out of this marriage. And I did it without anybody's help or support. And definitely, you know, that long period of time must have been draining me. You know, whether it was draining my adrenals or my white blood cells or whatever it is physically, I don't know. But what I know is it was draining the life force out of me.
Absolutely. I'm just moving on now to a point which when we met you told me about how you started to break the cycle and start to move towards recovery. And I'd love you to share your yoga story
with everyone. I had practiced yoga a long time ago and I knew that there was no way I was going to be able to do anything like a gym class or anything like that. But I'd heard about someone who's a really good yoga teacher. And I was bedridden at the time. And I thought, do you know what, I'm going to give this a try. And I phoned her and I explained my situation. And she said, definitely come to the class. It doesn't matter what you do and what you don't do. Because you'll be in the atmosphere of other people practicing yoga and you will pick up on their energy. So I decided to do it. So, you know, on Thursday mornings I would get out of bed, just put on some clothes, get a taxi down to the yoga studio. I would lie on the mat and I would spend most of the class lying on the mat. But I was practicing the pranayama, which is the breathing. And so even in a position of lying flat, I was in the most important yoga position because I was practicing pranayama. So I would lie flat and I'd practice the breathing. People around me would be doing all different postures. I never at any time felt embarrassed or ashamed. I felt great because I was there. I was in a yoga class. And then at the end of the class, I would get in a taxi. I would come home, get undressed and get into bed. And gradually, over a period of weeks, I started to do a few things, started to do a few spinal twists, started to do a few seating postures. And the weeks turned into months, and I actually felt a bit better. And this carried on, and I would then practice yoga at home. And over a period of 2 years, I progressed to the point where I was able to do standing postures. And one of my favorites now is warrior, because you stand in warrior, and the drishti is you say, I am strong. And you say this 3 times, I am strong, I am strong, I am strong.
Wonderful affirmation.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I love warrior pose.
Yeah.
Can you explain on the audio what a warrior pose looks like so that people know what they're aspiring to?
Well, you're standing with your legs about a metre apart and you're facing, say your face to the right, your right knee is bent, your arms are out sort of at shoulder height and you look along the right arm to your fingertips and it's as if you're holding a spear, but you don't even need a spear because you're strong, you're a warrior. And so you have this proud strong posture. And you know, you don't have to stay in it very long. You come out of it, you can rest again. That's fine. But yeah, it's my favourite too.
And I believe you were wrapped in a blanket, weren't you, when you first started? So from laying on a mat, wrapped in a blanket, from just literally falling out of the taxi and back into bed.
Absolutely.
Look how far you came with just that little bit of getting into that good energy.
Yeah.
It's a really, you know, it doesn't matter how small the start is.
No.
It's breaking that cycle of non-movement, isn't it?
It's breaking that cycle. And, of course, once you get into some of the postures, and it took me months to do it, but that doesn't matter.
No.
It doesn't matter how good or bad you are at it, because you don't judge yourself. Once you can get into shoulder stand and you get the lymph moving around the body, you get real physical benefits. And even if you can't do very much at all, you know, you can just run your fingers along your body. You start at your hands and you just sort of flick up towards your heart, and you do the same with your legs. You know, even if you're bedridden, you can do that. You can do the pranayama and you can just, you know, get there. I wish you could see this.
I know, we need to be videoing
you. But you can just sort of do these flicking movements so you get the lymph moving and so you feel the benefit of it.
It almost looks like Lucy is kind of scratching her arm, really.
Yeah.
You know, but you're kind of just pulling the fingertips up from the wrist upwards up to the arm, for those of you that are trying to figure out what it is we're doing here. In terms of, that was a major change, wasn't it? Starting
Huge.
To get into movement
Huge.
After being so, so poorly.
Yeah.
You also made some massive changes in your life, didn't you?
I did.
In order to get you to where you are today.
Yeah.
Would you mind telling us what, you know, what they were?
No, not at all. I had a very responsible job, and I worked as an administrator, and I was really, really frightened that I would lose my job. I had a mortgage, I had a home, lifestyle to support. And in fact, I lost my job through ill health. I was on sick leave for quite a long time, and I kept going back and doing one day, and then I'd be off work for 3 days, and then I'd try and do half my usual hours. And in the end, it just didn't work. It wasn't possible. It was beyond me. And so I lost my job. And then I was really afraid of having my home repossessed. And so I decided I'm just going to sell it. I'm just going to sell my home, and I'm going to repay my mortgage, repay my credit cards, repay all my debts. And this is what I did. Repaid everything. My elder son by then had left home. My youngest son went to live with his father. And this was a huge thing for me, because I just felt terrible. You know, I felt that I should be there for my son, and I wasn't able to be. And when my sister said to me, you know, I can't believe you're doing this, you know, you're selling your house and you're going to live abroad. And I said, look, it doesn't really matter whether I'm in this country or not. I'm not well enough to be a mother to my son. You know, I just can't do it whether I'm here or I'm not here. So, you know, that was my way of explaining it to her. But deep down, I felt dreadful that I was doing this. But I did it anyway. I felt I really had no choice, because this had been maybe years now, 4 years, and my health hadn't improved one bit. And so what I did was I sold my house. Okay, so with the money that was left, I went to live abroad, and I literally just went with suitcases. I gave away or sold almost all my possessions. And things I really wanted to hold on to, a friend stored them for me in her loft. And I went to Spain, lived for a while in Spain, then I came back, went to France, lived in the south of France for a while, and then I came back, went to the Canary Islands, came back, went to Greece, came back, went to Israel, spent quite a lot of time in Israel, and then I came back. And what's extraordinary is that when people say, how did you possibly manage, you know, to go and live abroad when you couldn't even, you know, look after your own home, you couldn't clean your own home, couldn't even do the dusting. And this is how I did it. I had wheelchair assistance at the airport, so somebody would take me to the airport, put my suitcases on the belt, I would have wheelchair assistance, couldn't climb the stairs onto the plane, so if it was possible, there's something that can, it's like a lift mm-hmm. that comes up and puts you on the plane. If that's not possible, people carry you onto the plane. This is what happened to me. When I got to the Canary Islands, two men carried me off the plane. And then I would get a taxi to where I was staying. I booked everything online because I literally wasn't well enough, you know, to go and talk to somebody and say, you know, I'm looking for a property or anything like that. So I would find something online and pay for everything online. So I'd go to the place, say, for example, when I arrived at the Canary Islands. I'd just get out of the taxi. The taxi driver would put my suitcases inside the door and I would go to bed. And for maybe 2 days, I would just sleep and drink water. And I'd take with me things like dried fruit and nuts. So I didn't bath, I didn't shower, I didn't cook a meal, I didn't go outside the front door. And then gradually, over a period of days, I would find the strength to maybe go out and have a meal. And I'd be somewhere where I'd just go and sit and have a salad and then come back. Or I'd have a bath and then get back into bed. Or I'd open the suitcase and put on clean clothes. So it was only one of those three things I could do at a time. So it was more of an existence than a life. And I couldn't possibly have shared that with anybody else. Because, you know, for a lot of the time I was dirty. Or I was actually too weak to talk. So it was actually better for me to be on my own. If I'd had somebody looking after me, I would even have found conversations too tiring. You know, sometimes I just couldn't have the light, had to have the curtains closed. And what happened was I gradually improved because I was in the sunshine. I was only eating healthy food, and that's when I stopped eating bread and I stopped drinking. I didn't even have a glass of wine with my meals. And I can remember my landlord in France saying to me, you know, you don't eat bread and you don't have wine. You know,
what are you doing here?
I know. What kind of diet are you on? And I said, you know, it's for my health. I have health problems. It's not a slimming diet. It's a health problem. And, oh, God, yeah. He thought this was terrible. I couldn't have bread and wine, you know, with my will. But I lost weight. My health improved. My gut problems diminished. I still had them, and I probably will always be sensitive to gluten. But I gradually, over a period of time, became very much healthier. So I was in the sunshine, I was eating healthily, I was getting a bit of exercise because I was doing a bit of walking, or even going to the beach and having a little paddle in the sea was much more exercise than I'd had for years. And I was away from all the hassle, you know, of everybody's opinion, and I had no financial problems because I didn't have a mortgage. Didn't have a property, I didn't have a door key, I didn't own a car. So from
like
being
stripping back.
It was
completely
back. Was
starting all over.
And from a point of being absolutely terrified of not having those things, I learned that I could actually survive without them, and then I could live without them, and then I could actually quite enjoy life without them. So that's how it was, and that was over a period of about 3 years.
It's been said, and I don't know about you, I agree with it, that a lot of the breakdown of the body mm-hmm. and the system is to do with an identity being in crisis.
Yes.
And from what you've said today, it seems like you'd reached that point where
yes.
you couldn't be authentic. You,
yes.
you couldn't be just
mm-hmm.
you.
Yes.
And going away, you could
yes.
literally
yes.
just find yourself, really.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, completely agree with that.
It's stepping off the world, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, I always believe that looking back, we see it as a gift.
Yeah.
And many people would like that opportunity.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it came with a price tag of very,
yeah.
very
yeah.
ill health and horrible experiences.
Mm.
You know, but however, it's if you could see Lucy today, she's transformed. So... We know before you got ill, you sort of had a a fairly demanding job, in sort of a kind of corporate setting, I gather. What do you do now?
Well, now I'm a healer, because something that I got into along the way, and I tried all sorts of things, you know, conventional medicine, alternative therapies, everything. I've tried everything. And I do think everything I did helped me a little bit. Kinesiology, homeopathy, cranial osteopathy, all sorts of things. They all helped. But the thing that helped me the most, two things really, were the Reiki healing, and yoga. And yoga is very much more than just a physical exercise. It helps on all levels. And this helped enormously. So I practice yoga. I'm a real devotee now. I practice yoga several times a week. But the Reiki helped me enormously. And I became a Reiki healer. And I received some Reiki healing. And then I took my Reiki 1 attunements. Then the Reiki 2. And then I went on to become a Reiki master. So what I do now is I give healing, but I also teach other people who want to become Reiki healers. And I absolutely love what I do. There is nothing I could do for a living that would bring more joy into my life or more satisfaction. And I do think that when I look back, maybe even to my childhood, but certainly the whole of my adult life, I was doing things that I felt were the sensible option. You know, business studies at college, and then getting, you know, very good jobs. Jobs that to everybody, including myself, looked like well-paid, responsible jobs. So they had status, they had salary, they had all these things. They weren't right for me. I wasn't really being true to myself. And it's like walking in shoes that don't fit you. You know, you keep going back to those shoes, but they don't fit. And I think over a period of years, I was given lots of signals that I was doing the wrong thing. And if I had wanted to, I could have responded to those smaller signals, but I didn't. And a lot of the reason I didn't was fear. What would other people think of me? How would I manage on less money? All sorts of things like this kept me trapped in something that was completely wrong for me. And I reached a point through the illness that I just had those things taken away from me, or I chose to give them up. You know, I chose to sell my house rather than wait for it to be repossessed. And once those things had gone, and it wasn't overnight, I mean, there was a long time when I just thought, whatever is going to happen now? Where's my life going? You know, am I ever going to be loved again? All sorts of really deep down fears came out. And I lived through them, and I learned through them. And over a period of time, I actually began to think, do you know what? I prefer my life the way it is now. And I would never in a million years have given up the job I had to be a Reiki healer. I couldn't have done it. I'd have said, you must be joking. How could I manage? You know, how will I live as a Reiki healer? Sounds very nice as a hobby. And here I am doing something I love.
Absolutely. It's what happens when you get off purpose, isn't it?
Yes.
And when you're not living your passion.
Yeah.
And using your gifts.
Yeah.
So one way or another, you get that massive wake-up call. And it's just unfortunately that ours was a long time.
And quite a severe
one. Quite a severe one, yes.
But what's lovely is now I'm able to help other people with ME. And I'm able to help the other people, not necessarily with ME, but with a whole range of issues and problems and health problems, because I know firsthand what it's like.
Yeah.
So that's a great gift. I mean, I wouldn't have chosen for 1 minute to have gone through what I've been through, and I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy, but having had it, I can help so many people. And that's
you
great.
Do.
And I do. Which is great.
Within that field, you're now working with people who are on that journey and are pretty much many of them back where you were in terms of their symptoms and the changes that they need to make. What have you learned about resistance to recovery with the people that you've worked with?
It's interesting. to be with people who are resisting recovery. And I have to distance myself from it and not become emotionally involved, because it's hard. It's hard for me because I want to rescue people and I can't do it. The only person who can heal somebody is that person themselves. And sometimes I listen to someone and I say something that will encourage them to make changes in their life. And they say, oh no, I can't do that. And I tell them, I say, you know, it might help to hear what I did from a point of saying, I can't do that. No, I can't give up my job. And this is what happened because I didn't make the changes. And it might help you to hear what I did. And they will listen, and then they will say, no, you see, I couldn't do it because such and such. And I just have to step back and say, okay, you know, you have to do what feels right for you. But what I always encourage people to do is look at what is in your highest interest. This is not an easy thing for a lot of people, and especially people who are resistant to healing. And I say, you know, anything that happens, and this can be as simple as, do I buy a ready meal or do I buy potatoes and peel the potatoes and do the whole thing together? You know, is it in my highest interest? Which meal is in my highest interest? Or if somebody asks you to do something, is it in my highest interest to do this? And if you can just allow that to come into your life a bit more, I guarantee that the people that are asking things of you will benefit from it. They may not see it as a benefit, but you are freeing them up to become stronger and more capable and to really grow and heal themselves. And you can't do that if you're rescuing them.
No.
Can't do that if you're always there for everybody. And another thing that some people do when they're reluctant to heal, and this is on such a deep level that I don't believe they even know they're doing it, they hold on to the illness because they have a vested interest in being ill. And this can be on a very, very deep level. This is not a conscious decision. No. Nobody would actually think, I'm going to stay ill to punish you for hurting me. But that's what happens on a very, very deep subconscious level. People are saying, now you've got to mother me. You were never a good mother to me when I was a child. Now I'm an invalid. Now you have no choice. You have to be there for me. And it's a horrible realization that this is a level at which some people live. Don't even know they're doing it.
No.
But, you know, if you can tap into that.
And you can see why nobody wants to admit to that.
Well, why would you?
You just wouldn't want to.
You wouldn't. You'd say, I must be completely mad.
But the point at which you look at what is the payoff or the,
yeah.
the vested interest
yeah.
in having and holding
yeah.
on to this
yeah.
is the point, I believe, when
yeah.
you've really reached the crux.
Yes.
Because without any shadow of a doubt, there's always some form of payoff.
Definitely.
And for me, I've been working since I was 12 years old.
Mm.
I've been the one that made up the difference, did the
yeah.
extra, took
yeah.
it on, would manage,
yeah.
would do, would
yeah.
always be there.
Yeah.
And somewhere deep inside me, it was like, oh, I can't keep doing this anymore.
Yeah. yeah.
Let someone else take the reins.
Mm.
But I don't, like you said, it was never, ever conscious.
No. No.
And that's the conflict, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you're fighting
yeah.
to get well.
Yeah.
But when you start saying that, it's
yeah.
a fight, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because the other part of you is saying, hold on,
yes.
you need to take some time out
yeah.
here
mm-hmm.
and do some sort of
yeah.
you know, self-exploration,
yes.
really.
Yeah. And for me, you know, in my family, I've always been somebody who could be relied upon.
Yes.
So, you know, you're strong, you're capable, you're intelligent, you'll sort this out for us. And this was all the generations.
Yes.
This wasn't just my children.
I bet you got to write all the letters for
yes.
the family whenever
yes.
there was a problem. Yeah,
yeah.
me too.
Yeah. Oh, this is wrong. You'll make the phone call.
Yes.
People didn't even need to ask me. They just knew it was going to happen.
Yes.
You know, tell Lucy, she'll sort it out. You know, this always happened. And, you wouldn't. I mean, you'd have to be mad to say, okay, I know how I'll stop doing this. I'll become so very ill that I can't live my life. And then you'll have to look after yourself. Who wouldn't? No sane person would do that. But there is an element of that, and there is always an element of that to ME.
The wisdom of the body.
Yeah.
To stop you.
Always an element of that.
Before the actual realization is allowed to come up, and we're allowed to sort of face it then.
And what I did, and what other people can learn to do, is just turn things around and say to those people, do you know what? Give it a try. How about saying this, or how about saying that? And at some point, you empower them. And it's amazing what people can do when they haven't got you to lean on.
Yes.
And for a lot of us, it's not just in the present day. It goes back. I mean, you said you started work at 12. I was rescuing people, from the age of 5.
Yes, and I think back, I was in some shape or form.
And it's inappropriate.
Yes.
It's not appropriate to ask a small child to be that responsible.
No.
It's enough that she's responsible for herself at the age of 5. To say to a 6-year-old, you have to watch carefully as you cross the road, is fine. It teaches that child to be responsible for herself. To say to her, she's got to look after somebody younger, or she has to rescue somebody older who has mental health issues when she's barely able.
Yes. Yeah.
To cross the road herself is inappropriate.
That's right.
And so what a lot of us have done, and this is very typical of people with ME, we had inappropriate expectations put upon us when we were children and when we were teenagers. So by the time we reached our 20s, we'd already lived an adulthood. You see, we'd already asked too much of the self by the time we became adults ourselves. And often it's this turning around. It's actually saying, I need looking after.
You've got to go back, haven't you, really, to that childlike stage where you are nurtured and nursed to get you.
Yeah.
It's almost like there's a book, I think, called Core Transformations, and it's about the inside part of you having to grow up to catch up.
Yeah.
Because there's a little part of you that, was, as you say, was too much was expected when you didn't have the skills and and the wherewithal to be able to say no.
Absolutely.
That's so brilliant, Lucy. Thank you. Before we close, I speak to you all day. I know you've given so much today. Have you got some kind of top tips or recommendations that you'd be able to offer to people that are kind of really in the sort of throes of and the grip of ME at the moment?
Yeah, I think the first thing is to accept that you have a neurological disorder. So it's not appropriate to beat yourself up and think, as I did, I'm a failure, I should be able to cure myself, or you hear a lot of nonsense about ME, about it all being psychological and a whole load of nonsense. Just switch off to the nonsense and just think, I have a neurological disorder. What's the best thing I can do for myself? What's in my highest interest? And definitely pacing is a great one, where you look at the amount of time you have, you look at the energy you have, and you look at what really, really needs to be done. And there are only 3 things that have to be done in a day. You have to breathe, you have to sleep or rest, and you have to urinate. And anything else above that is extra. There are people who don't go to the toilet for 2 days. I wouldn't recommend it, but you don't have to do it. So if you haven't been to the toilet, don't beat yourself up. My digestion isn't working well, I'm not eating the right food. Just give yourself a break. A lot of what we do is, it's self-harm. We beat ourselves up. And I think pacing, eating healthily. I mean, certainly try a diet without wheat and without gluten. It doesn't work for everybody, but it can't do you any harm. Give it a try, maybe for a month. And there are lots of foods out there now. You can buy in Waitrose, Tesco, Sainsbury's, food that's gluten-free. And just try that for a month and see if it makes any difference. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. You've tried it. So that's resting, pacing, diet, attitude. I think something that helps enormously, and this goes back to this whole thing of not beating yourself up, is the language we choose to think in. So instead of, oh God, I'm so weak, it's, I'm actually feeling stronger today than I did yesterday. Or I'm learning how to manage this illness. I'm actually quite good at this now. This is not boasting, this is stating a fact. I'm actually quite good at managing my energy levels now.
And I love the fact that, you know, taking away the word illness and replacing it with energy levels. So, for me, I don't know if you agree, it wasn't seeing myself as a person who was suffering anymore.
No.
It was seeing myself as someone becoming healthy.
I was never comfortable with being a victim.
No.
And I don't define myself as a person with ME. That's not me.
No.
You know, the illness happened. And probably I will have dregs of it in my system for the rest of my life. I know I will always need to take care of myself, maybe more than some women do. But that's not a bad thing.
That's a good thing.
That's a really good thing.
Absolutely. You've got a picture of health.
I don't make any apologies. And this goes back again to the attitude thing. I don't make any apologies to anybody. I don't say, I'm really sorry I can't do that because I've got ME. I say, I'm not going to be joining you, but thank you so much for inviting me. You know, it's really lovely you've invited me. Thank you, but I'm not going to be joining you. Or I will say to someone, this afternoon I'm having a siesta, and then I'm going to do my nails. And it's indulgence. You know, it's a good thing. This is me, looking after myself. So this attitude change is a big thing, and this is a tip. You know, it's so easy to think of all the things you can't do and all the things you used to do and all the things you'd like to be able to do. But to actually lie in bed, you know, at 7 o'clock on a winter's morning and everyone's out there, you know, going to work in the rain and I'm in the warm, and I just think, I am so lucky that I'm not out at the bus stop in the rain. And at different times of the day, I am so fortunate that I have plenty of time, because there have been so many years when I had no time. I didn't have a minute to myself, and I have plenty of time.
And that's what people crave, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we have it.
Yeah, we have time.
And you've learned how to make the absolute best of that time.
Yeah.
So I just want to thank you so much for all the wonderful words of wisdom, really great top tips there. And I think the language as well, changing the language. We love it. We're all going to have a siesta right now. So enjoy your siesta today. And just remains to say thank you again, Lucy. And I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon, because it's been an absolute pleasure.
My pleasure too. Thanks very much.